When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to five pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, hosted by me, Robbie Earle, and by my longtime friend, Kyle Schoenewell. Kyle, today is not just an exciting day because we're recording an episode of Friends from Work, and any day that we're recording an episode of Friends from Work is an exciting day, let me tell you. It's also an exciting day because this is the anniversary of the day that you were brought into this world. Happy birthday.
It's my birthday, yes. If you could say that in any weirder way, I would have loved it. I feel like Dwight Schrute, it is your birthday. Brown balloons that are like half inflated. One of the best parts of
that. That's one of my favorite birthday memes to send.
It is your birthday? Dwight. That's when Jim and Dwight are trying to work together, and it's amazing. And they're like, if you're trying to hurt my feelings, it's working, okay? But thank you. Thank you. I feel older, but I feel happy. I'm good.
There you go.
I feel really good.
There you go. Hey, it's a good life.
I also feel really good because we're getting really, really close to the Eternals, and holy crap, we have a jam-packed episode today. Can't wait to get into some of this stuff.
We do. Although, before we forget, as long as we're talking about your birthday, I just wanted to point out something that we dropped on our social media platforms yesterday, which is a little preview of an upcoming piece of merch that we're going to be releasing on the Friends from Work store that is, should we say, very Kyle-centric.
It is. I did not design it, for what it's worth, okay? I actually think the guy who drew it was incredible, and so shout out Jacoby. The artwork looks amazing. I think it is an accurate depiction of me. However, it just feels weird to have any kind of merch with your face on it. Like, it's been a long time.
Fair.
It's back to the band days before I since I've had that. But even with band merch, it wasn't my face, so this is strange.
I should say Kyle did. He put up a fight, and we all outvoted him and forced him to let us put out this piece of merch because it's just too good not to. But if you...
It is really fun. That's true.
If you see that design and you're interested, it's also a perfect time to sign up for Friends from Work Plus, because one of the big benefits there is not only do you get 25% off of merch when you're a patron, you also get early access to pre-orders of merch. So you'll be one of the first folks that gets to have your hands on these and that gets to see them once they're announced.
And what I'm excited about is that's not the only item coming, okay? We got some Robbie-centric merch coming too, so he's not going to get off the hook here.
That's fair.
We've been working on some fun t-shirt designs that I think you guys are going to freaking love, plus a few other things. Just some surprises. And so, yeah, if you sign up for Friends from Work Plus, that's a good way to be notified of all that stuff. Get ahead of it and get a little discount. Get a little money off that thing. A little money back in your wallet.
And speaking of Friends from Work Plus, earlier this week, we released the second episode in our Amazing Spider-Man comics walkthrough with me and Candace. And that was a ton of fun. It's been really fun seeing everyone's responses to these classic Stan Lee, Steve Ditko issues. And so if you are interested in kind of going on that journey with us as we move into Spider-Man No Way Home, in addition to the films that Kyle and I are walking through, Candace and I are walking through the comics as well. So that's mm-hmm. also available. We have two episodes out and the third is coming pretty soon.
And that's where all the Kraven jokes come from, just so we're clear
yeah,
on all that.
That's true.
And over on the Friends from Work side of things, the main feed, we're still going to stay in the Eternals realm because that's coming up really quickly.
It's coming up real fast.
We still have Spider-Man talk on the main feed too coming. So don't freak out. You're still going to get some Spider-Man love. Oh, a ton of it, actually, just as we get a little bit closer to that film release. Dude, right. The Eternals premiered on Monday, and your boys were not there. Soon, though. Soon and very soon, we're going to be there.
Yeah. If everything goes according to plan, I think we, and I always say that because you never know, but
yeah, true.
We should have seen it by the next time we're recording an episode. So,
well, crossed. Last time we said that, yeah. Yeah, it got a little messed up, but we will be going hopefully next Monday, so we will still know. But that's why we actually wanted to do this Eternals mailbag today, because I do think it's important that we do this mailbag before we know anything. So that mm-hmm. way, you guys out there, this is totally spoiler-free because I know nothing about the film. This is just our predictions, our answers to your questions. And then next time when we do a preview, hopefully we will have seen it. And so that will take a little bit of a different vibe.
Yep.
So the structure for today, we're going to do these mailbag questions. And then Robbie got a chance actually to chat with Douglas Wolk at the end of this episode. And he had a fantastic interview with him. Douglas actually went through every single comic. Think about that. He says the number in the episodes. It's something like in the tens of thousands.
Yeah, yeah.
Every single comic that Marvel has ever written and wrote a book on it. And this conversation is really fun, especially if you're into the comics. Robbie kind of geeks out a little bit, nerds out. And hardcore. But even for non-comics people, I was listening to this. I was very much enjoying it because he has such a positive take on the MCU as well. And positivity is a key word for Friends from Work, because I'm going to bring that up here in a second too. I love positivity. Holy cow. Robbie knows that too. And we're going to talk about that in a second. So stay tuned for that interview at the end. You're going to really enjoy that. Don't forget, you can go to the FFWpodcast.com. That's kind of our hub for all things Friends from Work. You can find our new Patreon link on there. There's a merch shop in there. You can contact us through there, plus a variety of other things. So check that out. Okay, but Robbie, before we dive into this Eternals mailbag, I just want to say something. The Eternals is directed by a newer-ish director named Chloe Zhao. And here's why this is important. You and I have been referencing on this podcast, oh, she did this movie called Nomadland that's really well received. It was an indie film that kind of blew up, and I think it was nominated for Best Picture.
It won.
It won Best Picture. And you and I were always like, oh, yeah, I trust her sensibilities. Full confession, I had not seen Nomadland. So that was kind of me just being like, yeah, I take Robbie's word for it. But I did go and watch it this last weekend, and I have so many takes on that movie, but without diving too fully into that, I just want to say that, holy cow, my big takeaway leaving the film was the Eternals is truly in good hands, I think. The best thing that she does in Nomadland, so Nomadland, you would think on paper, is a movie that's just going to be really, really depressing, right? It's about a lady trying to get over the loss of her town and her husband, and she's dealing with grief, and so she goes to travel. And it is a really, really sad film, but Chloe paints and highlights the positivity of humanity in that movie so well that I was blown away. And I thought, wow, that actually might be one of the things that she could carry over into the Eternals that I would love. Positivity is the key word of today. It's such a sad story that she handles it with such care. And it just made me really excited for what she could do with the Eternals. Seriously.
Yeah. That's one of the things that's made me so excited, because in one sense, Eternals is about as outlandish as we've gotten.
Right. Right.
The fact that it comes from a creator who has given us such this intimate portrait of these very human characters, I think makes me really excited, because I think that the blend of those is really necessary. And that's, I think, what the best Marvel movies have always done, right? It's, if you're going to go big on the spectacle, it's why I love Thor Ragnarok so much, because that movie is so wild and so crazy. But I also feel like you have some really kind of meaningful human moments in there. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, obviously some people disagree on that, but I think this in some ways could be more extreme on both ends. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think the summary of our coverage today, previewing the Eternals, is going to be just how wild we realize this is. Robbie got a chance to go back through every Eternals comic, and this is just a weird story. Holy cow. And so big swing galore. Like, I have no idea what this is going to be like. I'll know next week. But I guess I'm coming from the perspective of the way Chloe handled Nomadland gets me encouraged for the movie. The visuals in Nomadland are also really spectacular. It's a very slow-paced movie, but it is very moving. And you can just tell she understands story and dialogue and how that blends with the slow-paced visuals and the emotional impact. She gets all that stuff. So I'm very encouraged about that. And by the way, one last Nomadland hot take real quick. It's so good. And the actress in that movie, what's her name? Frances
McDormand, who also won Best Actress for that movie.
Oh, and she's amazing. And it's heartbreaking. And it's moving. And she's amazing. I left the film though, Robbie. This is so crazy. But I shut it off and I thought to myself, it's so similar to WandaVision in so many ways. And yet Frances is not doing anything better than Elizabeth did in WandaVision, in my opinion.
Wow.
Now the Academy's never going to see it that way, because it's a Marvel movie and because it's a superhero movie, they won't see it that way. Uh-huh. But just trying to be objective, I was like, Elizabeth portrays grief and getting over that as well as Frances does here. She just does, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's fair. There's such an unfortunate bias, but I think that that's one of the other interesting things about this is that we have a movie coming out that is directed by someone who won Best Director and who won Best Picture. So it's like, hopefully, if any movie could sort of get outside of that box, I think it's this one. And I think in some ways, some of the excitement around this movie that I'm seeing from non-Marvel fans is kind of a good sign. Like, it's been really hard for me to gauge how people are feeling about this one, because I just feel like it generally has a different vibe. The early reactions that we're getting from critics, without any spoilers, just seems like a lot of people are saying, yeah, it feels like a very, very different thing. And I'm hoping, you know, maybe that's what we need. Like, maybe we need something kind of like Black Panther again, that's going to shake everything up and let everyone know that, I mean, for the umpteenth time, that there's not one Marvel movie that's being made over and over again. That there are a lot of really interesting creators working within this universe, and that they're being given a lot of freedom, and that they're able to really kind of articulate their own vision. Because I think that everything I've seen from folks talking to Chloe Zhao, from folks talking to cast members, it really seems like whatever comes out of this, obviously it's going to be tied somewhat into the larger MCU, but it seems like it is her movie that she is very invested in, that people definitely feel like she was given a lot of agency in making. So,
holy cow, that's a hill you and I could die on forever. We need to get into the mailbag, but I'm not going to yet, because now you're inspiring me for something else. We talked on the phone the other night. Like, dude, if nothing else, I want this podcast to serve as defending Marvel and the higher-ups, like, to the death. This is the hill I'm going to die on. Like, dude, did you see the Oscar Isaac news? Oscar Isaac's talking about his filming of Moon Knight. And mm-hmm. he goes on this whole thing about how it's the most challenging thing he's ever done, but the most fulfilling. And he talks about how he brought ideas to Kevin, and Kevin was so encouraging and like, go with these, and this is great. And then I saw an interview with Jake Gyllenhaal on Howard Stern, where he was totally set up with a question to basically be like, haha, it's Marvel. That's not very, you know, creative. You're not very good with that. Haha. And he totally goes out of his way to defend Marvel and just how creative it was and how challenging it was and how much he loves that world and how he didn't want to mess it up. And it's just time and time over again, case after case after case after case of people being like, actually, it's the exact opposite of what you critics argue. Right. Marvel is the most creative, fulfilling place. They're letting you do whatever you want, and they're encouraging you in it. Every time we talk to someone inside, they all say the same thing. It's crazy.
And I think it, to me, it comes down to situations are
I just
never...
get so worked up when the narrative doesn't match the truth. You know what I'm saying? It feels like unjust almost. That's why I get right. so angry about it.
Well, I think people just want simple narratives. And people just want things to be black and white. So it's like, I mean, we've talked about this sometimes in the context of sports coverage and in movie coverage and in political coverage. It's just really easy to just figure out the, okay, this is wrong, this is right, and I'm just going to run with that. And I think within the movie world, there is this general superhero movies. So it's really easy to just throw Marvel under the bus, one, because there are so many of them, and two, because it's Disney, right? And it's like a massive corporation. And by the way, this is not, I think one of the frustrating things is this isn't us being like these corporate shills for Disney. Disney does plenty of stuff that I'm not crazy about. And there are higher executives for Disney that it's not like I'm huge fans of necessarily. But I think that what we're saying is...
Yeah, I'm not saying that.
what we're saying is when you look at the creatives... at the top of Marvel Studios, like, and I do think it's you should call them, like, Kevin Feige is an executive, but I think he's also a creative.
Yeah, they are the difference.
Stuff, you know?
They are
and,
the difference.
And yeah, I think it's just you, it is very fair if you see something where you feel like there's so much corporate interference and creativity is being stifled to call that out. What I don't think is fair is to just decide that's what's happening in spite of all the evidence to the contrary.
Oh, you don't think that's the case? Look at almost every other big intellectual property ever. They all have issues. Right. People like leave not feeling the same way. There's so many examples of this. We were talking on the phone. It's like, also, they convinced people like Scarlett Johansson to pour herself into this for 15 years, her career. Right. That's not just money. They find a way to get Michael Douglas to come back for 3 films or Robert Redford to come out of retirement. It's not the same as other places. There's something going on in the culture at Marvel that's very, very good and open and inclusive and creative and challenging. And that's what makes them different.
Right. Well, and I think beyond just Chloe Zhao's involvement, I think Eternals in a lot of ways is a great example of that. And that's why I'm really excited to see, I'm excited to get into it here, and I'm excited to see what all, like, I think this movie is going to spur a lot of new conversations.
It could end up being really, really bad. That's not what we're saying either. We're not saying everything they do is gold. But as we've said so many times, you and I appreciate the big swing and fail more than the cookie cutter and kind of succeed, if that makes sense. And this... I'm watching all these trailers and I just think to myself, I have such a Guardians feel right now, kind of, where it's like, this feels so different, so new. It's a group of people we know nothing about at a weird time. And it's a massive swing and it might end up becoming like Guardians and being that incredible.
Right.
And it might not. It might flop and we might see a version of what it looks like when it doesn't work. But I love them taking the swing and we'll see. Okay. Wow. End of rant. We asked for some questions on social media at the FFW podcast that you guys had before we have seen the Eternals. And wow, you guys responded. I got multiple pages of these questions and I actually got so many questions that it now has spurred an excellent idea from our manager, Pete. You ready for this, Robbie? I'm going to officially tease this. The next time we do a mailbag, we're going to set up a Google voice number where you guys can actually call and leave your questions, and then we can play your actual voices on the podcast instead of me writing all the questions down. So that saves time for me, but also fun that you guys can be more involved and we can react to your questions kind of live, if you will. How fun is that? That would be awesome, I think. So that's an idea I'm working on right now. But for today, I wrote them all down, and I want to start here. We got so many excellent questions, but there was two questions in particular that multiple people asked. Okay, so I think those are the ones we need to talk about first, because I probably got six questions that were exactly the same. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this is all speculation. We should say also, wow, last thing. There's been a stupid spoiler because of Variety magazine, and yes. I don't know what it is. I've 100% avoided it. I don't know. Unfortunately, my co-host, who I'm mad at, does know what it is. So that better not influence any of these answers, Robbie, because I'm pissed at you for doing that.
Hey, it happened to me. I'm the victim here.
But at all costs, guys, avoid spoilers. I don't understand why you want to seek them out. Why not avoid it and then watch the movie and experience it, and then you can talk about it all you want. I don't, like, don't go looking for them, please. So just be careful. They're really out there. They're very public, I guess.
Well, what's hard about it is they're not being marketed as spoilers at all. And what's tricky is this was sent to me by Candace. I can out her because she outed herself on the Slack there. She saw it and just didn't even realize it was a spoiler, like, because of the way that it's been positioned. So that's why it kind of sucks, because I don't even really know how to warn people to not see it, because it's not, like, the article may not even mention that it's an Eternals thing to give you time to look away, right? So it's like, it's really frustrating that media outlets, like, and I was looking back at the tweets where the stuff originally came from. It came from some Variety reporters tweeting right in the wake of the premiere, like you said. And it's just, one, the tweets are still up, the original ones, and they're so unabashed. It's not even like a hint. It's just like, hey, by the way, and it's like, okay, well, that's terrible. What is annoying to me, what I'm hoping is that behavior isn't just rewarded with a ton of clicks. I would hope that there's some kind of motivation to not do that again. And I would think that Disney has to have something in their arsenal. But anyway, it is frustrating.
It's so strange. This is kind of new territory for Marvel, I feel like. Because for the most part, I think they do a really, really good job of keeping these spoilers reined in. But for whatever reason, this one got out. Can we stop talking about it? Because I don't know what it is. And I'm even nervous that I'm going to start trying to guess what it is. And I don't even want to know. Yeah. I don't care.
Yeah, well, I can say that I've already sort of had planned what I wanted to talk about today. And that has not been influenced at all by anything I may or may not have seen from Variety.
Okay, good. Okay, finally now, after all of that, we have made it to our mailbag. Stay around for the Douglas Woke conversation. Let's dive into the first question from this mailbag after a quick word from Manscaped. Do you know what's even spookier than seeing a black cat on Halloween? It's shaving your body with anything other than Manscaped. And when it comes to men's grooming, Manscaped is here to upgrade your grooming experience. Join over 2 million men worldwide by going to manscaped.com for 20% off plus free shipping with the code FRIENDSFROMWORK. The Performance Package 4.0 also includes the Weed Whacker, a total game changer in your men's hygiene arsenal. The Weed Whacker is a nose and ear hair trimmer that provides proprietary skin-safe technology that prevents nicks, snags, and tugs in those delicate holes. Manscaped even threw in two free gifts to their Performance Package 4.0, the Manscaped Boxers and the Shed Travel Bag. Bring your comfort and boxers to another level. If you're looking like Wolverine and haven't cut your nails recently, be sure to look into the Shears 2.0 Nail Kit. They have a bunch of other life-changing products on their website, so be sure to check it out. Again, get 20% off plus free shipping with the code FRIENDSFROMWORK at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code FRIENDSFROMWORK at manscaped.com. Okay, the most frequently asked question by you guys was, Robbie, how big of an impact do we think the Eternals are going to have going forward? Some version of that, or like, are they going to stay around the MCU? What role will they play, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think?
So this is, this property is so unique. I've said this a couple times before. Jack Kirby was at Marvel famously through that early period working on Fantastic Four and a host of other things with Stan Lee. At one point, Jack leaves, goes to DC, does some really famous stuff there, including New Gods and Darkseid and a lot of the things that have become a big part of the ongoing DC universe. And then in the 70s, briefly comes back to Marvel, does a couple things, does several things within the Marvel universe that are generally seen as not as good as the stuff he had originally done that kind of helped found the Marvel universe. It seems sort of clear that he wasn't really invested in that world as much anymore and was more wanting to do his own stuff. Cue the Eternals, which comes in the late 70s and is initially his way of making something for Marvel under the Marvel imprint that is specifically not in the Marvel universe.
So, which is so key there.
Right. So what's really interesting is if you look back, you know, they print these collections of these old comics with the letter pages that contain the letters readers were sending in with their response to each issue and the questions that they had. And all through those letter pages, it's constantly going back and forth, you know, should the Eternals be part of the Marvel Universe? Should they not be part of the Marvel Universe? And there are people that were very much kind of taking sides and drawing lines. And Jack toyed with it some, and even he would insert Marvel characters, but then sort of step back and say, well, no, I'm only inserting these Marvel characters because the IP exists within the universe, if you know what I mean. So like at one point, like the Hulk shows up, but then no, it's not the Hulk. It's actually a robotic model of the Hulk that these Hulk fans have made. And then at one point, someone gets turned into the Thing from the Fantastic Four magically, but it's like, no, it's just an homage to the character that exists, you know? So it's like, so finally, Jack leaves the Eternals and some other writers come and take over, and the editing team at Marvel at that point is very eager to fully integrate it into the Marvel universe. And so they start going through a lot of hoops to figure out exactly how this slots in with the established Marvel history at the time. And that's sort of where we live now, more or less, where it's like, okay, it wasn't invented that way, it wasn't started that way, but like Peter Gillis came in and Walt Simonson and Ralph Macchio and made it canon. And then there have been some things that have happened since then with Neil Gaiman that we'll talk about in the comics episodes on the Friends from Work Plus platform that have kind of played with that even more. This is
so
a
it's
really,
a strange property. That's the point. It's yeah, a very yeah. unique thing.
And so the reason I say all that is even with that integration, you can't make these characters the center of the Marvel universe because they were just clearly designed to be kind of background fringe characters, which, by the way, I don't mean to say they're unimportant. I mean to say that the entire conceit of the Eternals is that these are people that have been operating in the shadows, more or less, that you haven't been aware of but have been around forever. So I say this to answer the question, how big of an impact that they'll have. I think it could be a big impact on the cosmic side. I could even see them, you know, kind of quote-unquote going public within the MCU and people being aware of them. But I think that if people are looking for the Eternals to be the new Avengers or kind of the flagship property that everything's revolving around, like it was with like Iron Man and Cap. Mm-hmm. I don't think, I'm not saying it couldn't happen. I don't think it would make a ton of sense given the nature of the property.
Okay, before I answer that question, quickly then, while you're on that vibe, someone else asked, what should they be reading ahead of this? Do you have a quick recommendation on what they could read?
Yeah, well, the Jack Kirby comics are sort of clunky, in my opinion, as great as Kirby is. I think he's a better artist than he is a writer. I think that a lot of the writers of the film have said that they're pulling from a lot of the original Kirby stuff. So if you're wanting to get the kind of raw Eternal stuff, you can go there. Just be aware that it's not necessarily the easiest reading. I will say my recommendation would be to read the 2006 Neil Gaiman Eternals run, where, in his own words, he was trying to kind of salvage the original spirit of the Jack Kirby run, because he felt like, in an effort to integrate this stuff more into the MCU, he thought some of the writers that followed Kirby had kind of done the vision a disservice. So what Gaiman does is he writes this little miniseries in the midst of the Marvel Civil War event. So it still fits into this particular slot in history. Iron Man actually factors pretty heavily into that series, as well as a couple other members of the Avengers that are on the like pro registration side. So it's kind of a fun, easy entry point because Neil Gaiman wrote it, assuming that you might never have read anything else containing the Eternals. So it's he gives you a little bit of background. He changes a little bit of the canon around, which people may or may not love. So I think it's only 7 issues. You go read that. You've got a good sense of who the Eternals are, who the Deviants are, who the Celestials are. And then if you're more curious, then I think you can go back and read the Kirby stuff and move forward from there.
To answer the original question, I need to give a little bit of background. When you and I started this podcast, we were always reviewing things that I had already become, quote unquote, an expert on. We had watched these movies for years. We had talked about them, etc. Then as we got to new content, I found that it was even easier for me to know things ahead of time about characters I already knew, right? So like when Black Widow came out, if we had done a mailbag for that, I could have easily theorized a million things on Natasha because I felt like I knew Black Widow so well. Same with Wanda and what that could have been. But this is a new time now for me where I know almost nothing about the Eternals, and that's how we've liked it, you know, the setup for this podcast, that I don't have a ton of the comic stuff and I don't know a lot about their background. I don't even know a lot of the characters. And I kind of like that because I want to go into the movie judging it just as a film. Where I do think my strengths lie are in that, in I have a production eye. So I think I can judge the film fairly accurately. But as far as leading up to it, I don't know a lot about them. So I'm getting educated by you just like our listeners are. And I kind of love that. However, just based off the vibe of the trailer, the way some people have talked about this film, I get a sense that they feel a little bit like a mix of the Guardians and the Watcher, where I think, I agree with you, Robbie, I don't think they're going to make the Eternals part of the new team up. I think this new phase is going to focus a lot more in on Shang-Chi, Captain Marvel, Doctor Strange, Spider-Man, and that's kind of the world they're building. I don't think the Eternals are going to factor a huge amount into that. I don't think it's going to be like the Guardians in that way, where all of a sudden, halfway through the next team-up movie, the Eternals all show up and like swoop in as these all-powerful beings. This is my guess, by the way. I'm guessing. I think it's going to be more like you're saying, where for some reason, like something they say in the story, whether it's that they can't intervene unless it's deviants and they have to stick to that or whatever, they're going to be more just out there in the background. And I think they're going to handle the power in such a way that we're not going to be asking ourselves like, oh, where are the Eternals? They could fix this, if that makes sense. I don't know how. I think this is going to be a little more of a standalone story. I think you'll hear about them and you'll see them, but it's not going to be the next team-up film. I agree.
I do want to say, kind of, I talked about this from the editorial side. I want to say briefly, because this might get to some of the other questions that have been asked. One thing that has to be addressed is the Thanos of it all. Because...
Well, that was kind of my next question.
Okay, perfect.
Well, the second most popular question was about their power levels. Like, are they gods? How strong are they? Would they have been able to defeat Thanos? If Thanos snapped, is there potential that they would be blipped? Are they more powerful than the Infinity Stones? Like, did they come before the Infinity Stones, which came first? There was a huge amount of questions about that, too.
So, okay. One, focusing on this stuff, I think, is largely going to come back to some of that Peter Gillis canonization era that we were talking about that I think has pretty much stayed true in the Marvel Universe, where you had at the same time the Eternals were being introduced, Jim Starlin was introducing Thanos and that side of Marvel Cosmic. And so these folks that were integrating all this thought that, okay, well, this is sort of a perfect time to make sense of all this. So this is what ends up happening, and this is now what is canon in the Marvel Universe, in the Marvel Comics Universe. You have like a million years ago, the Celestials, who are these like giant space gods that we've seen in the trailers that have this very Jack Kirby design, they come to the Earth, and there are these kind of early Neanderthal-style humans there that they start running these kind of crazy experiments on. And they basically come up with three versions of humans. The normal standard humans that just continue to evolve normally. And then the deviants, which they sort of give these crazy genetic codes where they're constantly changing, which is why they look so crazy and like these creatures, because they are all morphing in totally different ways. They have an unstable genetic code. Then the third category is the Eternals. And the Eternals are supposed to be the kind of keepers of the world that the Celestials have visited. And, you know, it changes, but the idea is the Celestials will come back and the Eternals are the ones that are supposed to have kind of preserved things according to a certain plan. I know this is like wild to listen to.
Okay, pause. Ego's a Celestial, right? Or was?
Yes, within the MCU. Not within the Marvel Comics universe, which is where it gets a little bit confusing.
Okay.
So I don't know how they're going to make sense of that, or if they're just going to say that they're... I kind of get the sense that they're going to say they're different things.
That was a question from Jake, so I was just curious.
Okay, yeah. No, it is
one of my
question.
Biggest questions, too, with all that is, you know, like, what if is probably different. But, you know, the Watcher always talks about how he was instructed not to intervene. And then in this trailer, the Eternals say, we were instructed not to intervene unless it was deviance. And I'm like, who's doing all of this instructing? Like, somebody else is above them. And I guess you're saying it's these Celestials.
Yeah. Maybe. Well, and the Marvel Cosmic side gets crazy, crazy trippy. Like... these Marvel writers were famously dropping acid, like literally while they were working on a lot of this stuff.
So that influences it a little
so,
bit.
So, yeah, I mean, it's like you get, like there is a character that is literally the concept of eternity personified. like there's a character that's like you have these like justice and fairness concepts that are personified. You have like time personified. Like it's
this
all
is
this
incredible.
Crazy stuff. So like the Celestials are sort of within that world, but they aren't necessarily the like top tier. But like
what's the top, you know, top tier? There's a I tier mean, above them?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I think there is like an entity in the Marvel comics that is just like the universe.
okay, hold on. We're gonna have to trust Kevin that he can rein this in and come up with some of rules for this, some kind of groundwork.
I think, yeah. I mean, so I think what's important is the Celestials did not create the world. The Celestials are essentially these insanely powerful beings that came and messed with the flow of human evolution. But I don't think that they are not necessarily above or behind anything else that we've seen happen in the MCU so far. Now, I mean, that could change.
In the MCU, you know, I'm rewatching. We just finished Guardians 1, which is unbelievable. But, you know, you see the Collector show that little clip of a being of power wielding the Power Stone and wiping out a planet. Is that a Celestial? Right. It looks like kind of the one we've seen.
I think that's a great catch because, yeah, I think so. At least I think James Gunn intended that to be a Celestial because it looks like a Celestial.
Okay, so then, according to the MCU, not the comics, is it fair to say that even the Celestials are treating the Infinity Stones as the all-powerful thing? The Infinity Stones are the top tier.
I think so.
Because it shows us them using them or needing them.
Yeah, well, and so that's why I was kind of going back to the beginning there is, well, a couple of reasons. To answer the Infinity Stone question, yeah, I think because the Infinity Stones are still supposed to represent like the essence of the universe itself, I don't think we so far, whenever we're in universe, I mean, the Loki stuff aside, I don't think we've so far seen anything that can top that. And so I think the Celestials can utilize the Infinity Stones probably, but I don't think that they would be more powerful. Like, I don't know. You could get into whether Thanos could have snapped away a Celestial.
Right, that's what I was, yeah.
And I think probably, but I think also, you know, they could get squirrely with those rules if they want. But that leads me to the Eternals part of it.
Alex asked that exact question, by the way. Shout out.
About whether he could snap away Celestials?
Correct, yeah.
That's funny.
Or Eternals.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I think so. The reason I gave that whole long origin story there is because what ends up happening after the Eternals are created is you have some Eternals politics where there are different leaders that emerge with different theories on how the Eternals should go about performing this function that the Celestials have left them with. And one group winds up branching off and going to this moon of Saturn, I think, called Titan.
Okay, now we're talking.
And there you have these two Eternals kind of from different tribes, and that's a whole long thing we can get into more later, wind up marrying and having children. And one of those children is Thanos.
Oh. Okay, so, now my mind just got blown.
Yeah, so it gets very interesting because Thanos is seen as this sort of... Every other Eternal we ever see looks like a human. Thanos, because I think it's in part stuff involving him being born on Titan and the fact that he's born from two Eternals from kind of different groups, he winds up kind of undergoing all of these different transformations and clearly winds up looking very different, and he's way stronger and more powerful than your average Eternal. So that kind of answers a couple questions that have come up. One, I think the Eternals could have a big impact because I think in some ways, this movie could wind up being a bit of a like Thanos spinoff where it's giving a bit of his origin story without necessarily ever having
you
Thanos in
know,
it.
I would lose my mind if that becomes the case, by the way.
I mean, I think in some ways it kind of has to be because Thanos is such a major player in the MCU, more so than I think he ever was in the comics prior to Josh Brolin's introduction. So, like, I think it feels like a weird opportunity to pass up if you're Kevin Feige and co., especially if they want to keep Thanos off the board and make that ending from Endgame stick, but still kind of work through that part of the mythology. So I think on the how important is the Eternal side, you know, I think it could be important if you care about Thanos. On the how powerful are the Eternals question, I think that if you're looking in Marvel Comics world, Thanos would still be considered more powerful than, I think, any one Eternal. So I don't think this is a, oh, well, if they had just stepped in, then they could have easily taken Thanos. I mean, I think you could argue that maybe all of them together could have taken out Thanos minus the Infinity Stones.
Yeah, say maybe once he gets them, though.
I think that's the
point of Infinity War at the end there, is that once he has them, power level-wise, it's over.
Right.
That's my takeaway from that movie. So I hope they stick to that.
Well, and I think the other thing that I really respect about the Eternals comics for the most part is that these are not, it's not this like one-upping moment necessarily where, okay, well, look, you know, you've seen Thor and you've seen Captain Marvel, but now there's even more powerful people and it's the Eternals. Like, they may be doing that in the movies, but that's not how it's generally been in the comics. One of the things that Neil Gaiman focuses on a lot is, okay, well, what is it if we're going to operate under this assumption that these characters are in the Marvel universe now, what is it that actually makes them interesting and unique? Because he says it can't be that they're just a group of people with powers, because we already have mutants, we already have Inhumans,
yeah.
You know, we already have, and yeah, just everyone like that's in the Avengers that has gotten their powers somehow. So he does a lot to focus, I think like Kirby did, less on, oh, look how insanely powerful they are, and more on the uniqueness of their purpose and the way that they're tied to the planet and the way that they're tied to the Celestials. And I think that's where it gets really interesting. So I think power level-wise, depending on who's writing them, I think that they are for sure on the upper side of power levels. Like, they're definitely closer to Thor than they are, you know, to, like, Spider-Man. But I don't think that it's necessarily something where they come in and they, like, totally... Like, I don't know that they're even more powerful than Captain Marvel, necessarily.
Okay. Well, and the vibe from the trailer, it seems like they're just approaching it different in general. Because the trailer focuses on, we've loved humanity and we want to protect that. And they make a couple jokes to, who's going to lead the Avengers now? Could you do it? And they're like, haha, I don't know. And so I think I like how they're approaching how this fits with everything else we know, if that makes sense.
No.
Even if they are more strong, it doesn't seem like this movie is sitting here to highlight their strength. Do you follow me?
Right. No, I think that's, again, where I trust Chloe Zhao to be more interesting than that. You know, like,
right. I think so too. I don't know that, but I think.
Right. Now, I say this, I would not doubt it if there are characters. I mean, like, we've seen that we have, like, super speed and, like, Icarus can do the sort of Superman-style laser vision. So, I mean, you could argue that these people, certain powers are, like, supersede other powers that we've seen. But I just don't know if that's the right conversation to be having. I think one of the really interesting moments in that Neil Gaiman run is because it takes place during Civil War, there's a conversation between Iron Man and the head of the Eternals where he's basically like, okay, well, you have to register because you're clearly powerful super beings. And we've just passed this law where if you're a superhero, you have to be registered with the government. And it creates this opportunity for the Eternals to basically self-identify as not superheroes, because they're saying, well, that's not really what we're even doing. Like, our work is not, like, our work is kind of behind the scenes, just generally, like what you're talking about, like protecting humanity from these, like, mega, almost meta threats. So it's like they're putting themselves into their own category, which I think helps the whole conversation of, like, one, well, where have they been? And two, are they more powerful than character like A, B, and C? I just think that's a healthy way to look at it. And that's one of the things from Gaiman's run that I would love to see them adapt here.
Okay, last two questions before we hear from Douglas. These are just straight predictions. You ready? Just straight up.
Mm-hmm.
Take a guess. One, from Chase, do you think any Eternals will die? I say yes. I think they're going to lose one or two. You?
See, that's a loaded question because in the comics, the whole thing about Eternals is that they can't die. The whole idea is that...
Okay, so what's your answer, yes or no?
I think no. I could see them having something happen that resembles death in the form of some kind of banishment or something like that. But the whole idea is that...
But what if in the MCU they kill one and they're all shocked? Like, I didn't think we could die. What? And it's just different.
I would love that.
That's possible.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think that is possible. I think one of the interesting things, though, is that they explore the fact that these characters have been around for so long and don't age and can't die. And I think that creates interesting motivations or lack of motivation for them as opposed to our human characters.
From Rachel, will we see any familiar faces? And I'll say yes. I'm not going to call my shot and say who. I definitely think post-credit scenes you will. Apparently the post-credit scenes were so crazy that the first couple showings, they didn't even show the credit scenes. They paused it.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, which is wild. So whatever it is impactful. I think, yes, you will. I'm not calling my shot though on who, although I guess the leading candidate would be Strange or Captain Marvel is what I would guess, I guess. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I could maybe see like Adam Warlock, you know, who's been announced for Guardians 3.
Mm-hmm.
But
that'd be really early because Guardians 3 hasn't even started shooting.
Right.
Yeah.
And I feel like he was just cast recently. So I don't.
Yeah, true.
But in terms of like cosmic folks that we already know. Yeah, I think I could see Captain Marvel. Maybe this connects to Shang-Chi.
A Shang-Chi cameo? Yeah, Shang-Chi cameo. I just thought of that.
With, you know, like the Ten Rings and whatever, like, artifact that they're supposed to be. But...
Right.
Which reminds me, by the way...
So yes or no. Which one are you choosing? will you see a familiar face?
Yes. I think so. But I don't know who it'll be.
Okay.
What
does it remind you of?
Well, yeah. So as I was thinking about the Ten Rings and those being sort of ancient, one distinction I wanted to make since I went through that whole Marvel comics chronology is in the comics, they're supposed to be, you know, hundreds of thousands of years old, if not like a million years old. And I think it's important to note that in the movie, from what I can tell, they're supposed to only be like 7,000 years old. And I think that matters because I think that sort of further suggests that they are not supposed to be these ultra mega powerful, like above all beings. Like obviously 7,000 is still really old, but it's like, you know, Thor is like 1500 years old, yeah. I think we've heard. So it's like, I think it tells me it's more in that category of things than they're like in the Watcher category of things, if that makes sense.
My big takeaway from what you said is you're right. They're going to have to find a way to make them slightly different. And I don't think it's just going to be that they're even more powerful and even older and even more godly. Just because if they're sitting in a writer's room trying to decide, okay, Endgame is done. What characters do we now want to add to the MCU? Who should it be? I don't think that everyone in the writer's room was just going, well, let's find who's even stronger and let's add them. I think they're thinking, what makes these characters unique, like you said? And then, oh, the Eternals are unique because of this. Like, they're not the strongest, but they stay in the background and they help and they're positive. Like, whatever. There's something else they're trying to run with, not just, oh, here they're stronger.
Right.
I think.
No, I agree. And I think, again, I don't think Chloe Zhao would be interested if that weren't the case.
I think so, too. Okay. I can't wait. We're seeing it, I think, next Monday, I hope next Monday, and then it comes out publicly on November 5th, which is 2.5 weeks away. So,
man,
we're really close. It's going to be a blast. get to go to the theaters and watch a new Marvel movie. Shifting gears, almost a 180, but not fully, because we talked to Douglas about the Eternals in this, and he has comics knowledge like you do. And so that's a fun conversation. But why don't you quick tell our audience a little bit more about Douglas before we hear from him? Because it's fun.
Yeah. So this was a ton of fun. This is one of the more just straight Geek Fest interviews that we've done on here. Douglas is an Eisner Award winning writer on pop culture. He's written on music, he's written on comics, and his newest book that just came out last week is called All of the Marvels. And like Kyle said, he took on this project of literally reading through every Marvel comic that is in continuity that's ever been published. So there are some things that were not strictly a part of the ongoing narrative that started with the Fantastic Four in 1961, and I think those he didn't read. You know, like Star Wars comics are technically Marvel, but he didn't read those because those aren't part of the universe. But it's still an insane feat. And so he, at this point, probably has more knowledge about Marvel comics than any one person. And he was just so much fun to talk to. It's like Kyle said, you would imagine that as someone who's coming at this from a bit more of a scholarly perspective, that he would have been kind of dry or maybe less willing to have fun with like the MCU side of things. And that could not have been further from the truth and from what happened in this interview. So we got to talk about a lot of Spider-Man stuff. We got to talk about Shang-Chi. We got to talk about the Eternals and a bunch of other things comics related. So here is our conversation with Douglas Woke after a quick word from our sponsors. All right. We are very pleased to welcome to Friends from Work, Eisner Award-winning writer of all of the Marvels, Douglas Woke. Woo! Douglas Woke, welcome to Friends from Work.
Thanks for having me here.
We have been really excited for this. I've been following your journey on Twitter a while now as you've been documenting this book. Yeah. And I'm really glad that we were able to get you on because we have a lot of our listeners already reading the book, even though it's only been out for a few days now.
Oh, great.
Since I was able to read the advanced copy, I've sort of been talking it up for a bit. Yes, and we actually... we're able to have some folks send in some questions.
Oh, cool.
For you. So I just wanted to start off, you know, one of the fun things about this podcast is it's fundamentally a Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast. Kyle does not read comics really. And I read a lot of comics. And so what's been really great is our listeners sort of are split down the middle as well. Right. And we always have folks that are really well-versed, more so than I am. And then we have some folks that are totally unintroduced at all to comics, but really interested in digging in because of the films. And so I love how much your book is really for both of those groups of folks. And so one of the things I wanted to ask you first off was, you know, I know you talk about this some in here. What did it look like for you to get introduced into this sort of crazy world of Marvel comics way back when for the first time?
Way back when. I mean, that would have been quite a long time ago. Around 1979 is when I started reading comics, you know, upstate New York, like staying at my grandparents' place. And I was a DC kid at first. I picked up Green Lantern, Green Arrow. I was like, this is great. Okay. I need to find out what happens next month. And then next month, I was like, oh, and Green Lantern is also in this other comic, The Flash. Oh, and there's this other thing that looks interesting. Oh, and there's a store down the street that sells nothing but comics. And they get them every week. All of a sudden, I'm a helpless junkie. 2 years later, you know, after coming in every week, basically, they're like, you know what, Douglas, we're just going to teach you to use the register. And so I ended up working there for most of my high school years. But Marvel stuff, like kid across the street from me, you know, he was buying Daredevil. He was buying Daredevil when it was Roger McKenzie and Frank Miller. pre-Elektra, and you know, he would read my Batmans and I would read his Daredevils. And then I started buying a few myself, and then I think that the thing that really kind of pushed me over the edge was picking up X-Men 138, which, for those who haven't seen it, is the issue that is a summary of everything that had happened in the X-Men series up to that point. It is very, very densely packed. It is the issue after the death of the Phoenix, which is like the big classic issue.
Right.
But it is like, here is 22 unbelievably densely packed pages of everything that's happened up till now. And I was hooked and I kept going.
Man, that's a great start. So I didn't realize that you had started with, although I feel like that was a really good era for Green Lantern comics whenever you jumped on board.
Okay. You know, going back to it now, I'm like, okay, yeah, I was young.
But my next question, which is maybe an extension of the first, is, you know, you've spent some amount of time reading comics, you've been reading for a while now, and then you come to this point now where you have read through all of the Marvel comics. For our listeners, for those that haven't gotten a chance to read the book yet, what is it that drove you to take on this Herculean task, to put it lightly?
the specific Herculean task being the Augean stables. I mean, it's a stunt. It's, you know, Evel Knievel jumping over 40 cars. It's Stephen Merritt writing 69 love songs. It's it was a way to do a big project that involved reading a bunch of comics. But I also loved the idea that it was just one big story, one big 540,000 plus page story, serialized over 60 years, reflecting the world that it came out in and the world that made it. That's huge and amazing, and there's nothing else that's quite like it.
Yeah, that's so true, and that's one of the things that I've really fallen in love with reading your book, is the way you're able to follow these kind of tapestries that have been woven. And I think what's really interesting that I think a lot of people, myself included, hadn't really thought about is that even though it's telling this one single story, these older issues, we can get them now through Marvel Unlimited, largely, not all of them by any stretch, but a lot of them. But you point out in the book that even though it's telling this serial story, at one point, you know, you had Amazing Spider-Man number 2 and it was out on the shelves. And then when it sold out, it was gone. It just didn't really exist anymore once those copies were thrown in the trash or whatever happened with them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was never intended at the beginning to be one gigantic story. There were just, it started assembling itself, like it had its own consciousness. And, you know, it's kind of cool. You know, Spider-Man shows up in an issue of Fantastic Four. And then, you know, a character from X-Men shows up in the Avengers and then makes reference to a thing that's going on over in Fantastic Four. And then in Journey into Mystery, there's something else that refers to that. And all of a sudden, it's a story. It's a story where all the parts are talking to all the other parts. And the superhero stuff wasn't even the first time that Marvel had done that. The first significant like crossover between titles happened 2 months after Fantastic Four number 1. And it was between Linda Carter, student nurse, Kathy, the teenage tornado, Patsy and Heidi, Patsy Walker, and Millie the model. These comics about like teenage girls, young professional women. And that was going on there. That idea happened there. And then it moved over to the superhero comics, which absorbed all the humor comics and all the comics, like soap opera comics and the comics about young women. And just as it absorbed the Westerns, it absorbed monster comics. It absorbed everything that Marvel had been doing and the American pulp comics had been doing up to that point.
Man. Well, there's a point in the book where you discuss the progression of the Night Nurse character. Well, what we now know as the Night Nurse character that began as Linda. And I that's one of my favorite moments where you are able to kind of view this entire story from the perspective of a character that a lot of folks may not even be familiar with, but maybe folks would certainly never think to view this whole saga through.
Yeah, I like, and so the thing about Linda Carter, Student Nurse, is it's not a good comic. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting, like, it's an interesting comic in the light of what came after. It's not, I'm not waving the flag for it. But I love the idea that you can think of this enormous story as being the story of one character, one woman who doesn't have any superpowers, who just wants to do what's right in the world. And you can really think about it as anybody's story. You can think of it as Peter Parker's story. You can think of it as Kamala Khan's story. You can think of it as, you know, whatever character you like, whoever your favorite character is. You can see it all through that character's lens, because it all kind of mostly hangs together. It doesn't all, mostly does.
Right, right. Well, and that's part of the work that I'm so impressed that you've done here. I found myself having read at least bits of most of the major things that you referenced here. But the themes that you're drawing out are a big part of why I want our listeners to go and read the book. And I won't spoil too much, but there are a couple that I really wanted to zero in on. Because over on another side of the podcast right now, we're doing, ahead of Spider-Man No Way Home, a read through some of the, I like the fact that you say not to break it down into essential parts, but, but some of the kind of seminal moments of Spider-Man, particularly through The Amazing Spider-Man.
Right.
And one of the things that I thought was fascinating and I had never thought about is the way you talk about Peter having these certain eras and these arcs that have kind of beginnings and endings that don't necessarily match up with what I think people would always consider to be the beginning and ending of eras.
Yeah.
And I was hoping you might talk about that a bit and then also maybe talk about how you came to view it that way and sort of have this realization that has been kind of mind-blowing for me.
Right. I mean, Peter Parker's life, like the joke that I make in the book is like, it's the Itsy Bitsy Spider. Like it starts out as how does this boy become a man? How does this kid who has lost his father twice over and is completely alienated from the world around him and is showing every sign of growing up to be Dr. Octopus, how does this kid grow up? How does he become a person who can be in the world? And that's a story that can't go on forever. Like, it's a story that has an ending. Eventually, he reconciles himself to the world, and that should be the end, but it can't because this, it's a franchise. It goes on forever. So something happens to just knock him down, knock him not all the way down, almost all the way down to the point where he has to start over again. So most of the comics that I was reading for this book, I read just kind of whatever order I felt like on any given day. Like I wasn't reading any kind of grand orders. Like, okay, today I'm going to read some Thor. Today I'm going to read some comics drawn by George Tuska. Today I'm going to read some comics with Fin Fang Foom in them, whatever. But Spider-Man, I was like, I kind of want to just read a whole lot of Spider-Man all the way through. And what I saw was that it was this cycle, and it wasn't a deliberate cycle. At least up to a certain point. It was not something that was imposed by the people who were making those stories, but it was a condition that was kind of imposed on it by the kind of story that Spider-Man has to be, of the guy who climbs up painfully in from this rock bottom position to the point where he gets knocked down again. And it just kind of broke down into phases that way. And then once I started thinking about it, like, I couldn't unsee it. I could not see it anymore.
It's so interesting because there are a lot of people that are particularly hung up, you know, on this transition between JMS's Spider-Man run and the Brand New Day era as a real example of a clear kind of regression of the character. I don't necessarily feel that way, but a lot of folks, I love both of those eras for different reasons, but I think a lot of people see that as such a clear, okay, we're going to reset, not just the plot, which clearly happens as a result of a particular moment in the comics, but also it is this, okay, you feel almost the tension with publishing and editorial of, well, we are supposed to have this adolescent story playing out, and this guy is starting to feel a little bit too much like he's an adult.
Yeah.
And how do we deal with that? And it felt almost like a, because you talk about how it's an unintentional phasing at first, but in that moment, it almost feels like they were recognizing the importance of that and enforcing it.
Yeah. And at the same time, when the brand new day period starts, there's this very clear sense of this is where Spider-Man has been in the past, and we're not going to retrace those steps this time. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do the same thing. It's a long time before any of the villains from the first 4 or 5 years of the series even show up.
Right.
This is a Peter Parker who has lost everything again in a different way. And he doesn't even know some of the stuff that he's lost, but he's going to have to build himself up from this other helpless position, which is being, effectively like a guy in his late 20s living in his mom's house.
Right.
And crawling his way up from that. And when the familiar elements start coming in, they start being mutated and changed and played upside down and played backwards. And, you can't get rid of Spider-Man's supporting cast. You can't get rid of J. Jonah Jameson. You can't get rid of Aunt May. They have tried. But it doesn't work without some of those things, but that doesn't mean that the relationships between those characters always have to be the same. And then Dan Slott comes in and slowly builds toward that superior Spider-Man period, which is somebody who knows the original iteration of the story cold, like knows it backwards and forwards, and completely flips it inside out and backwards.
Hmm.
And that's what superior Spider-Man is. It is Spider-Man played in reverse, upside down.
Yeah. Well, and so that works so well with the other observation you made about Spider-Man, about the fact that Peter, even from those very early comics and reading through those, I'm always struck by how kind of inherently unlikable Peter is at first.
Yeah, he's a jerk.
He is. Yeah. he's so, he knows he's smarter than everyone. And then you're right. You see how Otto's introduced in issue 3. And it's not all that different than how Peter was introduced in Amazing Fantasy.
I mean, all the way up to the end of at least the Steve Ditko period, Peter's kind of a jerk. There's that bit in the final Ditko issue where he's meeting the student protesters. And you can tell Ditko drew this scene as this guy's got no time for these guys. and Stanley softens that some in the dialogue. Uh-huh. But it's obviously he's angry. He's fed up. He sees a guy on TV who looks like Ned Leeds, like the guy that his old girlfriend is dating now. And he just punches the TV. I mean, he's not there yet. And I love that. We don't often see that in later Spider-Man comics. One that's an exception I actually kind of mentioned there is in the House of M period. Where we see a version of, there's a House of M Spider-Man series. We see a Peter that everything has always gone right for. Uncle Ben is still alive, and he is a universally loved superhero and pro wrestler and actor, and he's married to Gwen Stacy, and they have a kid, and he might be having an affair with Mary Jane on the side. That's not entirely clear, but it's kind of hinted at. And J. Jonah Jameson is his helpless lackey who he just bats around all the time. And he's a terrible person. He's a terrible, terrible person because nothing bad ever happened to him.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Because you're right. I think part of the reason I'm okay with us delving so much into Spider-Man here is it seems like he's, as always, found himself back in the public consciousness in a big way with No Way Home.
There's a new movie coming out. I can't wait.
I'm very excited. And you're right. I was thinking about this, Peter has now become, especially in the comics, and I would say in some ways in the more recent film adaptations, the kind of inherent good guy, almost in the way that Steve Rogers has traditionally been, where it's if nothing else, it kind of breaks down to he's always going to do the sacrificial thing. And I really like when it's pointed out that was such a left turn because of what happens with Uncle Ben, that it's not it's this inherent part of him that was always just going to do the good thing no matter what. It is really rooted in this transformative moment. And I think when that's lost, there's something about the character that's lost as well.
Yeah. I mean, he has this responsibility, but he doesn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
The classic Spider-Man moment is the one that we've seen a zillion times up to and including actually Homecoming, where right. Where like he's being crushed under this giant weight. Yeah. And you see him, like, as Ditko originally drew that scene, he's ready to give up. He's just bowing down beneath this weight before he finds the strength to throw it off. But he doesn't want to. It would be so much easier for him to give in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's kind of who he is too.
Which is why I think those periodic moments when they can, at least on the comic side of things, give you even what the Clone Saga was sort of attempting to do, and what Nick Spencer sort of played with the very beginning of his run, with, you know, the isotopic whatever it's called, split your personality. And yeah, I think that's true. I think it's important, and that's something that's been discussed a lot recently as people look at the lack of Uncle Ben in the MCU. And
didn't he finally get mentioned in What If a couple of weeks ago?
He did. Yeah. And you know, he had the suitcase in Far From Home that had Ben's name or at least initials on mm-hmm. it. So, you know, there are the little, and I'm actually very okay with the way the MCU has handled that. I'm not one of these curmudgeons because we've gotten two adaptations that have done the Uncle Ben thing.
Like we know who Uncle Ben is. Get on with the story. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. But I think now we're at an interesting point of, well, now that it's sort of, we're coming to what has been billed as the conclusion of this trilogy, whether that's just marketing, whether that's true, you know, are we going to see that kind of guilt that's always been kind of at the core of Peter that hasn't necessarily made its way in yet?
I'm crossing my fingers that we see Miles. I think that would be an amazing way to keep the story going with somebody who's not maybe too old for the role.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can get rid of a lot of baggage there. And, you know, we get to see more Donald Glover that way, hopefully.
Right. Exactly.
But I appreciate you patiently talking through Spider-Man lore with me there.
Oh, gotcha.
But there is so much in here that I felt a little bit like you were reading my mind, because two of the eras that we preach about so much, or I say we, that I preach about so much on the podcast and Kyle puts up with, are the kind of the Bendis Dark Avengers era and the Hickman Avengers saga.
Yeah.
And I feel like you dove into both of those so masterfully. And I wanted to start with the former, because I thought something that I had not really considered that you pointed it out really well, is that, you know, now you read this Dark Avengers era, and we read it post this time that's been, you know, maybe one of the most politically problematic and strife filled times in recent memory, at least over the past couple decades, I would think. But that's not when it was written, right? Like even I come back and I've revisited it mostly since then, but it was written, you know, at a period where, President Obama had just been elected, and in some way, I mean, his approval ratings were very high, you know, for a modern presidency. And just in general, you talk about how kind of prescient that run was. And that was another thing I wanted to kind of pick your brain on, because I had never thought about how, you know, Brian Michael Bendis sort of unintentionally previewed the next decade of American life.
You could see the rise of the right and the rise of Fox News and mm-hmm. all of this stuff just bubbling up. And some of it comes up in that Warren Ellis Thunderbolts period that leads into Dark Reign. But, you know, I mean, it was there and it was coming. And the people who made Dark Reign like came up with a way to dramatize it in a way that's really, really interesting and was a little bit out of step with its moment and in step with a moment that was a little bit later. Interesting to see, because, you know, comics are very often behind the times. Like they're a few news cycles behind. You know, Dazzler shows up 3 years after Disco. So yeah, that was interesting to see.
Yeah. Well, and then there's a lot of focus on that period now as well. And one of the reasons I highlight that, because a lot of folks, us included, have hoped that we're heading towards a kind of Ellis Thunderbolts, Bendis Dark Avengers era on the more like geopolitical side of the MCU
right. These
days. But then, okay, we have to, before I dive into more MCU focused content here, the Hickman Avengers run is, yeah. I think it's my favorite one run or one saga, however you want to think about it, in all of comics.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it has to be anyone else's, but I think it's such a powerful sci-fi epic that I think is just on a scale that I don't know has been, to my mind, replicated with the level of detail and care that I feel like Hickman gave to this saga.
Yeah. And there are parts of it that are weird or awkward or don't quite hang together, but as a whole, like, it's 93 issues long and it's through plotted. Like, mm-hmm. there is stuff set up right at the beginning that pays off right at the end. There are motifs that run through the whole thing. Like, it was clearly conceived as a unit. There are stories of the like Marvel Writers Conference, creative mm-hmm. conference, where Hickman came in and presented his plan for this thing. And I'm probably misremembering the story, but the story I heard is that, you know, he talked for hours on end. Like, he had this gigantic vision that he laid out, and everyone was just like, whoa. All right. That's cool. Yeah, let's do that. Okay.
No, which I can see. I mean, it's one of those things where I always feel a little bit nervous recommending it, because I feel like it works on one read, but I think it works much better on a second read in some ways, because he's got so many moving pieces and he's doing there's some stuff that just, it almost requires an understanding of the, like, you have to be able to stand back and know what the full story is before you can really start to understand how all the pieces fit together.
Right. You know, I lent it to a friend of mine a few years ago who didn't really know the characters at all, but was curious about it. And mm-hmm. She devoured it. But the one question she had was, she came back and, like, there's that guy who, like, comes back from outer space or something near the end. Who's he? And yeah, that's Hank Pym, and it doesn't get explained. Like,
that's so true.
He forgot to explain who this character is and why it matters that he's shown up there.
Right.
But yeah, as a single conception, have you been reading the Hickman X-Men stuff at all?
I have been. Yeah, I'm not fully up to date. I think I'm a couple issues. I haven't started Inferno yet, I should say.
Okay. Did you get to the end of the X-Men run?
I did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So, I've been enjoying that so much. I've been enjoying, like, that whole line and watching what happens with all those different stories by all these creators just lined up so beautifully with each other.
Mm-hmm.
I sat down and figured out at some point that between the end of X of Swords and the Hellfire Gala,
mm-hmm.
two weeks pass in story. 2 weeks. Everything fits into a 14-day timeline.
Really?
Yeah. And it all just clicks together with King and Black in the middle for a day and a half.
Uh-huh. Like, a day and a half. Man.
Of course, it also means that, like, the timing of those comics can't. So the Hellfire Gala claims that's happening on the summer solstice.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, like, about a week after King in Black, which has to happen on Christmas. Like,
right.
There is stuff in King in Black that is specifically Christmas, like Immortal Hulk, but uh-huh. you know, Santa Claus shows up. Uh-huh. And which means that if that does happen there, the Hellfire Gala is a New Year's Eve party.
Right. Right. That's awesome. Man, okay, so that actually perfectly leads me into one of my questions, which is, how did you figure out that? I think what you say is, from the time the Fantastic Four come on the scene until mm-hmm. the time when modern Marvel comics are being released, is a period of about 14 years in universe, give or take.
Yeah, I mean, that was not my calculation. That was like, okay, this about makes sense. That is the rough supposition that you've seen show up in various comics in the last few years. It's
okay,
14, 15 years, something like that. Let's not be too specific about it, maybe, please. Right. Yeah.
Right. I think it's so interesting because that's one of the things that folks that start reading comics, including my wife, has just started reading, and it dawned on her for the first time, which is why I was saying, well, this is why all the Marvels book has been so interesting to me. She had no idea that the Peter Parker she's reading in these 1960s comics is also the Peter Parker that I'm reading in the Nick Spencer and now Zeb Wells comics, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think the fact that that's part of what makes it so intimidating for a lot of people to come into. And that's one of the reasons why I really like the way that you position. You have a whole chapter on kind of how to break into this very intimidating world. And so I was hoping that given your experience here and having delved in, that for folks that are listening right now, that hear me reference these comics all the time, that have inspired a lot of these MCU stories that they love, that you might have some words of wisdom for how to even start and how to pick up a comic and how to start on this whole crazy ride.
Yeah, I mean, it is okay to not know everything. Nobody is supposed to know everything. Nobody is supposed to have read everything from the beginning. It's okay to come in anywhere. There'll be some stuff that you don't quite know what it is, but, you know, if you start the MCU with watching, I don't know, Hawkeye, whatever, or let's say even better, like Winter Soldier. Winter Soldier has a lot of backstory. Loki has a lot of backstory.
Right.
It's fine. It's entertaining. Mm-hmm. There are names that will stick in your head. You'll figure out what they are later.
Mm-hmm.
If the first movie you see is Thor Ragnarok, like, who's this big green guy? You'll get it. It's fine.
Right.
It'll come to you.
That's true.
It's really, really fine. Like, go to a comic store, go to a well-stocked library or bookstore, look through some books, flip through the first couple pages. If they grab you, then that's a story you want to read. If they don't grab you, it's not the story you want to read. If they grab you and confuse you, well, they grabbed you, right? You're fine.
I came up in the 90s era of Marvel, which I think was big on confusion.
Yeah. I had my book release party a couple of days ago. Laura Hudson came and I had a few people like talk about like individual issues that meant a lot to them. And Laura was talking about the 1992-93 X-Men number 21, which is the Psylocke. There's like two versions of Psylocke and they're fighting each other and they both have purple hair. And who is anybody and why is anybody doing this? And can I read the next one now, please?
I read that's so funny because that was one of the first X-Men comics I remember reading. And I'm going from the X-Men animated show.
Yeah. And that is exactly what she did.
Right. And then I'm like, I remember I had the exact same reaction. I was like, I have no idea, but I need more of this.
Yeah.
Whatever it is that just happened in my brain.
Exactly.
Well, you brought up the MCU some and the way that I think increasingly as the MCU goes on longer and longer, it starts to reflect certain elements of the Marvel Comics universe in the way that it operates. And one of the questions that one of our listeners asked, which I thought was really interesting, is as you've kind of undergone this whole journey and, you know, assuming that you've stayed kind of up to date with the Marvel movies along the way, has it made you, or are there any projects that you've found yourself particularly excited for now, having become kind of fully immersed in those comic character backgrounds, maybe a certain type of character more than another, a type of story more than another?
I mean, I'm so excited for people to discover Kamala Khan. I'm so psyched for Ms. Marvel. That is just such a fantastic character.
Mm-hmm.
I was really, really curious to see what the Shang-Chi movie was going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
And because I've got a whole chapter in the book about Master of Kung Fu, which I love. And that is,
which is one of my favorite chapters, because that's one of the comics I've never read, because I always thought, oh, that's a problematic comic. I'm just going to stay away from it.
It is a super problematic comic, and it's also super great.
Yeah.
And it's also super problematic. Like, you can't get away from that. Like,
right.
If you like to be fully committed to, like, everything about this thing is good, don't read Master of Kung Fu. If you think, as you know, the poet P.A. Hein once said, problems worthy of attack prove their worth by hitting back. It's a fantastic comic to read. It's tough to wrestle with, and it rewards wrestling with it.
Well, and I have to ask your thoughts on Eternals as it comes, because I just finished my read through of, I think I've caught all of the issues that the Eternals have ever appeared in. And it is a trip.
It's weird. I mean, the Jack Kirby Eternals is visionary and also kind of incoherent. Like, that is the period of Kirby where he was just, his brain was exploding with ideas, and it's not always clear what he was trying to communicate. But there's amazing spectacle on the page, but just there's like, it's really hard to grasp it on a kind of human level. And there have been a lot of attempts to do Eternals comics over the years, and they're almost always like indebted to Kirby and can't really do Kirby. And there's interesting stuff, like the Neil Gaiman, John Romita Jr. stuff is really beautiful, and the Kieran Gillen stuff recently has been, it's a really thoughtful take on it. It's really nice looking. It's still really kind of hard for me to get into, even in the way that I can get into stuff like Thor, which also doesn't have a lot of a ground level human dimension. On the other hand, I completely trust Chloe Zhao as a director.
Yes.
I love Nomadland. I'm super, super curious to see what this movie is and what it's like, and maybe what it gets from the source material. Like, I don't care if any MCU movies are, quote, faithful to the source material or not. They're a different thing. They're a different medium. They have an enormous pantry full of ingredients that they can use at will. I'll watch them.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I totally agree. And I feel like often the comics fans are sort of put into this category of people that are mad anytime the movies depart from that source material. And I think that's so silly, because we say this all the time on the show, but you have that, you know, have the comic, and that's not what's beautiful either about it. And now it's a different medium. But no, I think what I thought was so interesting about reading Kirby's era of Eternals was that we had Abraham Reisman on earlier this year to discuss his Stan Lee biography, which was fantastic. And, you know, there's always this conversation of what was Lee's contribution and what was Kirby's contribution and Ditko's contribution. And one thing that I realized reading the Eternals is, okay, you know what? Stan Lee had a contribution.
There's this great line from Neil Gaiman, actually, where he was talking about his collaboration with Terry Pratchett on the novel Good Omens. And he used to say, you know, well, what people don't realize is I actually wrote 90% of that book. But the other interesting thing is that Terry also wrote 90% of that book.
I love that.
That's how collaboration works. It is not a there can be only one sort of situation.
Right.
And Lee and Kirby at their best had that amazing chemistry where they were each bringing 90% of the project.
Yeah, that's such a great way of putting it. And, you know, Neil Gaiman has a great way of putting most things. Well, I have just one more question that I'm sure you've been getting a ton, but I have to know. As you came away from this, and it sounds like it's maybe still ongoing, because it seems like you're staying somewhat up to date with the comics that are coming out. Was there something that you came away learning that you didn't expect? Was there something that you ran into on this whole journey that kind of caught you by surprise?
I mean, there were a lot of little surprises. There were comics I was not expecting to be as good as they were. There were comics that I remembered as being significantly better than they were. You know, occasionally something gets visited by the Suck Fairy. but I think when I started looking into the relationship between especially the early stuff and what exactly was happening in the news around the time of like 1960, 61, 62, that was really interesting. I mean, the Hulk is not just a story about radiation. It is not just a story about the A-bomb. It is a story about the end of the atomic bomb testing moratorium. Huh. That is a thing that had happened just about immediately before Kirby and Lee started working on the first Hulk story.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. Huh. Like, it's the world and it's coming into the story piece by piece somehow. And I'm sure it's happening even now with the comics that are coming out now in ways that we don't necessarily recognize or that are hard to see. I'm sure like 10 years from now, we will look at comics from 2021 and go, oh my God, that was so 2021. Like that was these scarred, traumatized people coming out of this awful moment and coming into another kind of awful moment. And these are the stories they were telling.
Man, that's such a good point, which I love. I mean, I like that I feel like that's good art and it's really good pop art, you know, whenever it's reflecting the time that it's coming from. And I say that you're keeping up with this, that's also inspiring to me that you've read how many thousands of comics?
So it was just over 27,000 issues of Marvel Universe stuff. Wow. When I finished, I was like, all right, I've got a big pile of prose books. It's time to read some other stuff. And then that afternoon, I went to my favorite local comic store. I was like, ooh, there's a new issue of Hellions. Okay.
Yep. That sounds familiar. But no, you know, that's to folks that are listening that haven't delved in, that's the thing about it. It's an addiction, but I think it's a beautiful addiction.
Pretty much.
Well, Douglas, thank you so much.
Thank you. This is a treat.
Oh, I so enjoyed it. And I seriously did this book. I flew through it. I sat out on the back porch. I talk about, it's funny you say that because for the longest time I've had trouble, cause I have so many comics in my stack that, it's hard for me to turn to the prose books that are also a large stack, but this is one that, was, you know, admittedly kind of a cheat. But I flew through it and I'm absolutely going to continue pointing our folks in that direction. And you know, you should know you're always welcome here in the comics corner of Friends from Work.
Thank you so much.
So yeah, hopefully we can see you again next time you've read the next decade or two of
Marvel. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much, Douglas.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Well, I'm glad you got to nerd out there a little bit, Rob. It was fun to listen to, but I helped facilitate that interview and I called you when it was done and said, first of all, excellent job. You brought out a lot of great questions for him. But secondly, I was again just so loving his positive vibe towards all of these comics and towards the MCU. Like you said earlier, this is totally a setup for someone to be like jaded at this point about the comics and like, I don't like this. He read thousands of them. So it's
right.
I could totally see him being like, oh, this is dumb, whatever. But everything was through a positive lens, you know? And then that line about the MCU is a different thing. So you have the comics and you have the MCU. That's what we always talk about. So I was just floored that he brought that up without us even prompting him. And I loved it. I loved his positivity and his defending of the MCU being a separate thing.
No, absolutely. It was so refreshing.
All right, guys. We are on the doorstep of the Eternals. So stay spoiler free. Stay in touch with your friends, Robbie and Kyle, at Friends From Work. Check out Friends From Work Plus, if that's your thing, on Patreon, patreon.com/friendsfromwork. Check out our website, theffwpodcast.com, and don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and follow us on social media at theffwpodcast. We're just getting started. More fun things to come, and so we'll see you next time, same place, same time, on Friends from Work.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.